Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival and Ruby. And she wants to welcome all of you to the program today. And perhaps we can get her quieted here in just a minute. That's why I keep a bag of treats on my desk anymore. As you can see how well it works. Anyway, you're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, August 3rd, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, happy Tuesday, Melody.
Absolutely. And again, I want to apologize to the listener for all the barking in the opening, but that might become a regular thing here. You know, it kind of brings a different perspective to the program, I suspect. You have to be a little worried, though, if you ever hear Ruby start talking. So anyway, we'll have the market update presented by Ruby Grace. Anyway, today we had a little bit of pressure on gold today, down 220 right now in the New York spot price aftermarket at 1812. Silver, though, was up 16 cents at $25.66. Platinum was down 8 at 1,054. Palladium was down 34 at 2,732. And the paper markets today, you have the U.S. Dow was up 279 points, 35,117. The S&P was up 36 at 4,423. The NASDAQ was up 80, 14,761. Europe, all was good except for Germany. They were just down a little bit. Asia was negative across the board. 10-year yield. Oh, well, you know, it's 1.176, 1.176, just up just a fraction on the 10-year yield. And, you know, that's pretty much it. I mean, I think everyone is looking forward to that Friday jobs report. And that's going to carry us through another up week. And I think that's what's going on now. So, again, it's holidays. Kids aren't going. Some kids are going back to school, but as the majority, it's still small. But there's a lot of things we're going to talk about. Household debt. I was just prior to the program. I was reading. You know, we talk a lot about the supply chains. And now there's we've talked about this in the past, is the trucking crisis. Can't get people here to work, but we can bring them in from overseas and get them abroad, bring them in to drive trucks. So, hey, why not? Nobody wants to work here, so I don't know. I don't know what the thing is, but what I do know is household debt rises to the highest level in 14 years. And that's during the second quarter. And, of course, that's mostly to a surge in the housing market that brought the collective American IOU to just a shy $15 trillion. Total debt balances jumped $313 billion in the April to June period. And that's the sharpest rise since 2007. Ring a bell there, ladies and gentlemen. As a share of total consumer debt, that represented a 2.1% increase, and that's the fastest pace since the fourth quarter of 2013. But I think most of the gains came from the mortgage originations, both initial purchases and also the refis. And, of course, why wouldn't they be when the borrowing rates are near zero? That should encourage anyone to refi. Mortgage balances increased $282 billion for the period. That's up almost 3% just from the first quarter. And the swelling debt numbers weren't just about mortgages, with non-housing balances up a whopping $44 billion, Dave.
Yeah, notably, credit card balances increased again. $17 billion they increased. Auto loans up $33 billion. Student loan debt actually decreased during the period, falling about $14 billion to just below $1.6 trillion. That comes as forbearance programs have kept education-related balances in check, Melody. Indeed, government efforts overall at getting consumers through the pandemic resulted in low delinquency numbers pretty much across the board. And in total, 2.7% of debt was reported to be in some form of delinquency. And that's a 2 percentage point drop from the fourth quarter of 2019, just before the pandemic hit. However, those breaks are expiring in the coming months, and that's going to pose challenges to borrowers who will now have to get current on their loans pretty fast. Joel Scally at the New York Fed said there are 2 million borrowers in mortgage forbearance still who are vulnerable to financial distress once these programs come to an end. Now, interestingly, at least in housing, though, the credit quality of borrowers has been unusually high. The median credit score for the newly originated mortgages was 760 during the second quarter, with 71% of all borrowers having a score of over 760. So go figure.
Yeah, I find that hard to believe. We're 71%. Nah.
I mean, perhaps it shows how standards have changed.
I think
since
so.
Since the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, you know, I see advertisements on television that if you do, we can raise your credit score just by doing this one simple little thing. And so maybe that has kind of pushed them all up to 760, but I don't buy that at all. But anyway, factory orders, they rose 1.5% in June. Thank goodness for stronger demand for airplanes. Oil and other industrial goods. Now, this has surged, you know, well beyond the pre-pandemic levels. New orders have risen in 13 of the last 14 months, reflecting the resiliency of the economy in general. Durable goods, those orders rose 0.9%. The biggest increase in new bookings involved commercial planes. How about that?
Yeah. Orders for non-durable goods, you know, things like food, clothing, drugs, and the like. These are prescription drugs now. Advanced 2.1% in June. The U.S. economy has generated plenty of business for manufacturers, so much so they can't keep up because of shortages of labor in particular, but also supplies. And that's been putting upward pressure on prices, one of the things that has. Now, these hurdles are expected to fade over time, at least according to a number of mainstream economists. But many companies have had to raise prices for customers or even curtail production. Orders for capital goods, excluding aircraft and military items, which is seen as sort of the bellwether, the proxy for how business is doing, manufacturing in particular, rose a revised 0.7%. That's up slightly from the 0.5% that was estimated. Now, these are known as the, quote, core orders. They show a big surge in investment this year as businesses prepare for whatever becomes the post-pandemic world. I say, Melody, let's see where we are in a few more months before we jump to any conclusions.
Well, I mean, if you look to durable goods, and if the majority of that is airplanes, oil, and industrial, that doesn't include refrigerators and, you know, things that the normal household purchases, correct?
Right.
So when you see, so how good is the economy? Not too many of us are out there buying commercial airplanes and so forth and whatnot. So, you know.
Well,
Just if you're a professional sports player.
Yeah, right. So, you know, again, it's really it's interesting to see in the headlines read, you know, everything is rising 1.5% for strong demand, but, you know, seems to be a little lackluster when it comes to the things that the consumer actually purchases.
Yeah, for everyday living.
For everyday living. So, but hey, their credit card purchases sort of support. So again, a lot. This is what I mean. All of these numbers that they come out, they just, if one is strong, you should have it strong in all the other areas too. And it just doesn't seem that way. So I would think that the credit card debt is going to survival more than it is to out there purchasing airplanes and refrigerators and so forth. You know, like maybe they're paying their bills, or maybe they're helping to pay their credit card bills or their debts in other ways. So we'll see. As you said, Dave, we'll see in a few more months. And we've had an economy for what, the past 30 years, 40 years, buy now, pay later. But that is also one of the hottest parts of technology. And we're talking about Europe. It's built on the idea that the simple pay, that you simply pay in installments plan, doesn't really feel like a loan, especially when it comes with zero interest. Right, Dave?
Indeed.
Now that the idea has driven Square to acquire Australia-based BNPL giant Afterpay for about $32 billion in stock. Dave, do you think most of our listeners know what Square is?
Nope.
Would you like to tell them?
Oh, it's just a, well, it's a hardware and software program. It's a point of sale system that didn't revolutionize cashless payments in person, but a lot more. Particularly small businesses are using the Square software and the Square that you insert your debit or credit card into for in-person purchases.
So tell us about why this is interesting.
Well, you know, consumers who are unwilling or unable to open traditional credit cards can still be persuaded to borrow money if the marketing message is attractive enough. And now we see market leaders like Klarna recently bought an influence marketing company, has used the rap star Snoop Dogg and ASAP Rocky as its pitchman. Klarna's chief marketing officer said last week that introducing a new way to borrow money should be a bit like when Nike drops a new sneaker. Now, Square has already bought Tidal. That's a struggling music streaming service founded by the rap star Jay-Z, Beyonce's husband.
Boy.
And it's seen its growth of its Cash App turbocharged by more than one of these hip hop stars and other social media influences. Now, this buy now, pay later thing, particularly as Melody mentioned in Europe, what sets it apart from traditional shopping is how it repackages debt into a form of self-care. I like that explanation. It comes from Kitty Drake. Europeans who've traditionally avoided credit cards, they still want to buy items online, even when they don't have the full amount available in their bank accounts. And that's where BNPL, buy now, pay later, comes in. It now accounts for over 7% of European e-commerce transactions. That's a lot. It's only 1.6, I believe, percent, 1.5% in the U.S. But investors are assuming that young consumers, particularly here in the United States, will adopt BNPL. So we'll see what happens. Right now, apparently, the relationship that Affirm has with the internet connected Peloton bicycle company is driving it in our country. So it's interesting. Markets without broad credit card adoption in some ways are becoming more attractive. Indonesia's market leader, Credivo, for example, is going public at $2.5 billion valuation. This stuff is insane. As to what's next, Melody, well, soon, whenever you buy a big ticket item at a store with a Square terminal, you'll be able to opt to pay for it in installment. Usually up to 12 monthly installments at 0% interest, and it's taken directly out of your Cash App account. Boy, Melody, the times, they are a-changing.
Well, this isn't too much like the old layaway plans, you know, that the stores and Sears and Penny's used to have, where you go in and you can lay away on installments and they wouldn't charge you interest or anything like that.
Yeah, you're right. Fundamental difference is that you can take it home up front and rather than waiting until, you know, you paid it off like you did in the old days.
And like QVC, though, they do the same thing. QVC, you can do it on installments. And after your first payment, then they'll send, you can buy it on the first thing. But they don't, and I don't know, they just charge your credit card. The credit card is still involved with that. Because then they'll just charge your credit card at the next installment. So this is just, and they want you to use their credit card. Now, I don't know if you do the installments on QVC, if they charge you interest on that or just their credit card. So that is a big difference there. So and this they would be taking right out of your bank account. More and more people getting your bank accounts and more people, I hear people getting into their bank accounts and taking out that money. It's just, man, I hate sharing any of that information to anyone. So it doesn't matter who it is or what I'm buying. I just don't like to share that information. And, we talk a lot about jobs, not people not going back to work. Now, there's a lot of people saying that if companies raise their pay high enough, then maybe they wouldn't complain about labor shortages that have forced them to forego sales. But there seems to be a limit to how much a company is willing to pay, despite what seems like a clear opportunity to maximize their top line. So as we talked in this program, companies large and small have been scrambling to staff up amid this supposed rapid economic recovery. We'll finish this up when we come back from the break. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk Radio. CommonSenseRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedars from 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. You know, folks, there's all kinds of predictions out there that, you know, come October, come August, come September, come next year, come 2022. It's like, who are these people? They're always wrong. And nobody ever remembers that they're wrong. And yet they still have this loud voice. And it's okay to make predictions, but they're always wrong. Just know that things are changing. And things are changing very rapidly. If you care to read behind the headlines, and if you take a look around and open your eyes, you can really see where things are changing. And doesn't really see financially to the better. Another great article by Pat Buchanan. I mean, the trillions of dollars that are on these, I'm not sure if we're going to talk about them today, but all of these stimulus bills, I think you do have something on it, don't you, Dave?
Yeah. In what context?
I mean, just, so it was a really good article. And you have to remind me, Dave, to get these Buchanan articles over to you so they can go in the into the newsletters when I find one or two that are good. And I sometimes forget to send them over to you, but,
sure,
me
too.
But yeah, great. So, it really is incredible how everything, Dave, it's like, what planet are we on? What planet are we on, Dave? But anyway, yeah. You know,
we will talk in the third segment, about that subject with a little twist. Some revealing of some data based on recent research by David Stockman that is very counterintuitive in terms of stimulus's effect on productivity, Americans' productivity.
Yeah.
Not what you think it would be.
No. No, you're right. But it fools everybody, though. It fools everybody.
Sure does.
It paints a picture far different than what's really happening. And heading into the break, we were 1-800-375-4188. We were heading into the break. We were talking about after we got done with the buy now pay later about how high companies are willing to pay to fill their bankruptcies. I mean, there's still a record 9.2 million job openings. And it seems that employees are getting more desperate to fill jobs. And I mentioned it at the beginning of the program, truckers. So that's what's going to happen. They're going to bring them in from overseas. So that's...
Yeah, they that's can drive over there at 18. Here it's 21.
Yeah.
Via 16-wheeler's commercial driver's license.
So do you really... Which do you think they would prefer to do? Bring someone in from overseas to drive their trucks? And probably pay the same or less? Or do you think they're willing to increase wages? I think they'll take the latter. I think they'll take the one that will cost them the least. You know, but for now, increasing wages, we've seen it in the fast food places. It's essentially a bet that today's demand is going to persist. I don't know if it justifies higher labor costs in the years to come. Companies don't want to be in a position to reverse that decision. Companies are hesitant to lower wages. What generally happens is that companies don't decrease pay during a recession, but they are hesitant to increase pay after that recession ends. Yeah, they don't decrease pay during a recession. They just lay you off.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's what happens during a recession.
Yeah. Okay. Much of these labor shortages are occurring in industries that have already thin profit margins, you know, particularly the leisure and hospitality industry, where the risk of profits turning into losses is already extremely high. And most employers just can't offer higher pay to just the new people. Especially in the thin margin businesses, if you pay to attract the newer workers, there's going to be internal pressure with or without labor unions that you also have to pay and to keep and retain your staff that's been there for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, there's a wide array of logistical reasons a company could have job openings that it's putting off filling. You know, it could be severe supply constraints. They're just not paying to aggressively recruit because they lack the inputs to produce, even if they had the labor to fill these vacancies. Now, while there appears to be a disconnect between companies that are complaining about labor shortages and what they're doing about pay, this bias in the labor market seems to continue to favor workers their wages. One expert observed wages are on the rise across a number of industries right now, making the hiring environment all that more competitive. So we'll see what happens. Firms are either going to pay up for inputs and labor today, or else their competitors will. So that could have an effect on driving this up as the months go on, Melody.
Yes. Well, you know, it wasn't that too long ago that Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, had told a congressional panel that failing to raise the debt ceiling would have catastrophic consequences that could bring on a financial crisis. Well, they didn't. July 30th deadline to either raise or suspend the government's statutory debt ceiling. Extraordinary measures to keep the government afloat, she said she's going to begin. And I did see where she started to do things already.
On Saturday, yeah, August 1st. Didn't waste any time there, did she?
Well, they can't. By law, they're not supposed to, but if they follow the law. She respectfully urges Congress to protect the full faith and credit of the United States by acting as soon as possible. That's so funny. So they're going to use the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said in analysis that the Treasury would exhaust its special powers sometime in September or October. Absent action from Congress, the U.S. would default on its loans at that time. A default from the federal government would precipitate a chain reaction of cash shortages that could hit bondholders, including the people, businesses, and foreign governments who hold the U.S. debt. I only care about us, folks. And it could also lead to an immediate spike in interest rates. Dave.
Why is it that Janet just gets under our crawl? I mean, she said on Saturday that the duration of these extraordinary measures was uncertain right now because of the economic impact from last year's shutdowns on federal tax receipts. I just don't have a good idea of how much money is going to be coming in, particularly as a new fiscal year gets underway October 1st. Now, she noted last month that raising the debt ceiling doesn't prompt more federal spending. It only permits the government to pay back what it's already spent and what it now owes. She wrote a letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Failure to meet those obligations would cause irreparable harm to the U.S. economy and the livelihoods of all Americans. I guess presumably because of the spike in interest rates. Congress last suspended the debt ceiling for 2 years in 2019, but now many Republicans and some conservative Democrats are balking at raising the debt limit without ensuring
a certain level of spending cuts. That's what happened when Republicans controlled Congress under during the Obama administration. Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, suggested last month that the Dems would have to raise the debt ceiling this time around on their own, which means they're going to have to do it through the budget reconciliation process somehow.
Well, yeah, and I don't know. I mean, you have all of these bills that are all these stimulus packages. They're all set to get approved and so forth and whatnot. And, that's all part of it. These are all positioning themselves, and it's just disgusting. It really is. And we all know the debt ceiling doesn't mean anything anymore. They're going to continue to do what they have to do stuff. They're going to raise it at the last minute. They'll go through all these theatrics, and the timing is always, So it's just, here we go again. And they'll do it, and then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's all distractions. I don't know what will happen. I don't know what will be because I do believe they will default on their debt. I'm just not sure how it's going to happen. It's going to be because they didn't raise the debt ceiling? No, I don't believe that. I think there'll be some sort of a catastrophic event that will force them into not, or it'll force them to default on the debt. And I don't know what that could be. I could list a dozen of them probably. But, I'm not one of those people who go around and saying this is going to, I'm not going to take one of those 12 things and say that's when it's going to happen on December 21st, 2021 at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Eastern
time. See? That was a Freudian slip, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. So anyway, here's a guy. Here's another fund manager who he's talking about seeing gold at $3,000 to $5,000. Should have been there already. But hey, this Diego Perea, he manages the $250 million Quadriga Igneo Fund. And said there isn't widespread awareness of the long-term damage that has been caused by ultra-loose monetary and fiscal policies. Says these artificially low interest rates have created these asset bubbles. They're about too big to burst, and they are ready to burst. He said, adding that it will make it very difficult for central banks to normalize without risking their collapse. This is the default. The tapering process will be glacial in terms of speed. I agreed that. He correctly predicted in 2016 that gold would climb to a record within 5 years. He thinks the drivers for gold strength not only remain strong, but actually have been strengthened. And he's sticking to his view that gold's going to rise $3,000 to $5,000 in the next 3 to 5 years. And I think one of the most important things that he said here is that it's going to, the tapering process will be glacial in terms of speed, and I think also, and
that's the scary part.
Yes,
it's not necessarily that there's going to be such a significant correction in the paper markets. It's that it's going to happen before we know what's happening.
Yep.
And therein lies the catastrophe.
Yes. We'll wake up one day, as I've been saying for years and years, we're going to wake up one day to a totally different world. Financially.
Yeah. Yeah. This guy's perspective is interesting. We haven't read too much about him. It's typical with the precious metal fund managers. They typically fly below the radar, even when it comes to their mission, in this case, gold and silver. But we know that treasuries have been rallying since the end of March, even as inflation has picked up, and that's pushed 10-year real yields, inflation-adjusted yields, to a record low, negative territory. That would typically raise the appeal of holding non-interest-bearing bullion by a big time. With prices, they're still well below, well, $200 roughly, almost three below last year's high. Gold's disconnected from some of the moves in Treasury and real yields, but Korea thinks it could get a boost from major risk-off events that would make it clear that the Fed and other central banks aren't in control of the money markets as much as people. He said his fund managers remain focused on their mandate, i.e. gold and silver, platinum and palladium, and nothing has fundamentally impaired their view. Here's another quote worth remembering. Central bank money printing isn't really solving problems, he said. It's delaying the problem. Gold will benefit purely from being a physical asset that you cannot print. Melody.
Nope. And remember in 2020 remember the coin shortage?
Yeah.
Do you believe it's returned?
I saw that. That's like, whoa.
Now, this is the recent statement from the Federal Reserve said that the problem that there's a coin shortage isn't production, it's circulation. And the U.S. Mint has been operating basically at full production capacity since the mid-June of 2020. They produced 14.8 billion coins. That was a 28% increase from 2019. As businesses reopen, more coins will flow back into retail and banking channels and eventually into the Federal Reserve, which should allow for the further rebuilding of coin inventories available for recirculation. But issues with limited coins in circulation first arose last summer, as we all recall. Continued surge in online shopping and use of debit and credit cards has contributed to the problem. I don't know how that would contribute to the problem.
Well, circulation, you mentioned, Melody, 48.5 billion coins in circulation, most sitting in people's homes and not being used. We have a good idea about how that could be used. Today's prices, it would buy over 26 million ounces of gold, about 13.4 tons, or about 1.9 billion ounces of silver. 950,000 tons. Call us 1-800-375-4188.
We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TimUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody, who's taking care of client orders this third and final segment. Call her at 1-800-375-4188. Pointing to a number of reasons why a digital version of the U.S. dollar should be created, Fed Governor Lyle Brainard is insisting that not having one won't lead to a viable future. Brainard, whose name is being bandied about as a potential successor to Jerome Powell to chair the Fed when his first term ends early next year, believes a digital dollar will have both international and domestic applications. With other nations, most notably China, moving forward with their own digital currencies, Brainard has highlighted the urgency around the development of a digital dollar here. In speaking to the Aspen Institute Economic Strategy Group last Friday, Brainard said the dollar is very dominant in international payments still. And if you have the other major jurisdictions in the world with a digital currency and the U.S. doesn't have one, I just can't wrap my head around that. That just doesn't sound like a sustainable future to me. Monkey see, monkey do. Brainard's statement comes as the Fed is gathering public feedback on the potential costs and benefits of issuing a central bank digital currency, CBDC as they're known as, a discussion paper that will also cover design aspects is expected from the Fed in early September. Now, Brainard went on to list various reasons why a digital dollar is needed. She said one of the most compelling use cases is in the international realm where intermediation chains are opaque and long and costly. I'll have to follow up on that intermediation chain. On the domestic front, she turned attention to the rise of cryptocurrencies backed by fiat money, but not by a government, or so-called stable coins. Stable coins could proliferate and literally fragment the payment system, Brainard warned, also noting that one or two of them could achieve a certain level of dominance. In a world of stable coins, she added, you could imagine that households and businesses, if the migration away from currency is real and very intense, would simply lose access to a safe government-backed settlement asset, which is, of course, what currency has always provided. So did gold the day. Brainard is convinced that a digital currency could be instrumental in solving other important problems as well. For example, she believes it would help overcome difficulties with government payments reaching people that don't have bank accounts during a crisis like the pandemic. Now, let's see. Our latest American Survival newsletter hit the streets late last night. You can sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. As I mentioned in the last segment, my article features something written recently by David Stockman, who says, the Fed has been peddling an economic narrative that's totally unwarranted. And as usual, the devil's in the details. Stockman, who served as director of the Office of Management and Budget during most of Ronald Reagan's first term as president, argues that we are dealing with narrative. Facts and analytics be damned. The Fed's absurd money pumping is so convenient for both Wall Street speculators and money movers as well as Washington's debt-addicted politicians, that no one questions the narrative. He says, no one points out that the emperor of improved economic growth and performance is butt naked. Now, to understand the Fed's responsibility for what Stockman calls the inflationary disaster facing the country, he believes it's necessary to start with the big lie that underlies all of its destructive machinations. The claim that market capitalism gravitates towards cyclical instability, recession, and chronic shortfall from its potential full employment path. In this presumption, he adds, deft action by the central banking arm of the state is purportedly needed to compensate for the inherently prosperity-retarding imperfections of the free market. Stockman posits that if Fed policy has been reducing cyclical instability and pushing the economy closer to full employment, then productivity growth should be rising over time, commensurate with the Fed's more aggressive deployment of its stimulus policies. Stockman, in fact, believes that productivity growth is a stronger measure of monetary impact than real GDP growth, because the latter, he claims, is in part driven by long-run demographics and the annual growth of labor supply. Productivity growth, he adds, has exhibited an indisputable decline over the past 72 years, even as the Fed policy has become dramatically and chronically more stimulative. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Stockman divided the post-World War 1947 to 2019 period. He ended when the pandemic began, when productivity growth averaged 2.14% a year. Now, he divided that period into three sub-periods that he says roughly track the ratcheting up of Fed stimulus. During the first period, and we'll get more details in a minute, the Fed was still tied to the Bretton Woods gold exchange standard and really had little room for stimulus. During the second period, the Fed was just finding out how far it could actually go with a pure fiat dollar. And the third stage, which began with the Great Recession, was when the Fed unleashed boundless and unchained stimulus. During this last stage, the Fed's balance sheet exploded, in fact, from $900 billion to $7.9 trillion in the 13 years following the pre-crisis's peak. Stockman's research indicates that Fed stimulus and productivity growth are, in fact, inversely correlated and in a big way. In the realm of Disraeli's and Twain's lies, damn lies, and statistics, Stockman rightly points out you just can't argue with the facts. Nor, he added, can the Fed and their apologists claim that long-term productivity growth is not an appropriate measure of their policy efficacy. Stockman says, in fact, that the Fed is really in the anti-prosperity, pro-inflation, money-pumping business. Now, these following figures show that the Fed got steadily more aggressive in its stimulus during the three periods I mentioned. First was the gold-anchored dollar era from 1940 to 1970, where you take 2.4% Fed balance sheet growth divided by 6.6% average annual GDP growth, come up with a 36% stimulus ratio. Fairly modest. Initial fiat dollar area, that's the next one, that's 1970-71 to 2007, right before the Great Recession started, where you have a 6.7% Fed balance sheet growth divided by 7.3% average annual GDP growth, producing a 92% stimulus ratio. And then there's the third period, 2007 to 2019, he calls the unhinged fiat dollar era, where you have 12.3% Fed balance sheet growth divided by 3.1% GDP growth, yielding a 400% stimulus growth. Oh, in other words, Fed balance sheet growth divided by annual nominal GDP growth equals Stockman stimulus ratio. In 2020, the pandemic year, the Fed's balance sheet skyrocketed by $3 trillion more. And that came even as money GDP shrank, resulting in a 13-year trend that was even more insane. 17.1% Fed balance sheet growth divided by 2.9% negative GDP growth equals 590% stimulus ratio. Insane. At the end of the day, Stockman concludes of his numbers, the only real policy tool the Fed has is its printing press. Namely, it cannot really move interest rates lower, implement QE, ease financial conditions on Wall Street, or accommodate better economic performance on Main Street, except by expanding its balance sheet. Thus, Stockman argues that the ratio of growth in the Fed's balance sheet to nominal GDP growth is an excellent proxy for its level of stimulus. And on that measure, i.e. stimulus, the results are the opposite of the productivity trend that you see in official Fed charts, where the line is upward sloping ever continually from 1947 until through 2020. Stockman asks, how did productivity grow by 2.7% a year from 1947 to 1970, double the 2007 to 2019 rate, when the Fed's balance sheet grew by a mere 2.4% a year, or just 38% of the growth rate of nominal GDP? Let me say that again. How did productivity grow by 2.7% a year from 1947 to 1970, double the 2007 to 2019 rate, when the Fed's balance sheet grew by a mere 2.4% a year, or just 38% of the growth rate of nominal GDP? That, ladies and gentlemen, is a question worth pondering, especially when the Fed and its chart is what we get from a government that seems hell-bent now more than ever on dumbing down the public. Indeed, as my engineer friend once told me, to get the right answer, you have to ask the right question. Okay, we have time to get through at least a little part of this last story. Michael Snyder, who some of you may know as the author of the weekly Economics Collapse blog, says, it's the beginning of August and a day of reckoning has finally arrived for renters all over the country. As we know, since last September, a moratorium that was issued by the CDC has been protecting millions of renters who've been unable or in some cases unwilling to make their monthly rent payments. But now that moratorium is officially over and all of that back rent is due in addition to future monthly obligations, for some renters, that'll mean nearly a full year of rent will need to be paid, and paid fairly soon. Millions of Americans that cannot or will not pay what is owed can now be legally evicted. And Snyder says it's a major national disaster that's building up, that's been building up for many months and is now upon us. Snyder writes, I'm quoting, welcome to the biggest eviction horror show in American history. It is going to be a doozy. Now, some are still hoping that members of Congress will do something once they return from their August vacations, or that in the meantime, the president will find some light from his White House lawyers that gives him the ability to do something by executive order in the meantime. But it looks like there doesn't appear to be any hope of averting the largest eviction tsunami that any of us has ever seen. Of course, it was really inevitable that this day was going to come sooner or later. I mean, what else could we do? Did anyone actually think It'd be possible to tell landlords that they could never collect rent again. That they, you know, if they were told that, there wouldn't be any more landlords or ladies or properties to. So many landlords out there are really hurting financially right now as well. In fact, some of them have not been able to collect rent from certain tenants since the eviction moratorium was put in place last September. Now the wait's over, and landlords have nearly a year's worth of eviction notices to file if they choose to do so. As we speak, thousands of landlords are likely racing to take advantage of the opportunity they suddenly have. Well, whatever happens, we're talking about a massive number of people here. According to multiple government and media sources, the expiring eviction moratorium was the only tool keeping literally millions of tenants in their home. The Census Bureau says 3.6 million Americans are potentially facing eviction within the next 2 months. The Aspen Institute says that over 15 million Americans are currently at least 1 month behind in making their rent payments. In fact, more than 15—in addition, nearly 6 million homeowners are behind on their mortgage payments, with 8.7 million living where the homeowners have little or no confidence in their ability to pay what's owed. I don't know what's going to happen. Perhaps the government will just step in again, doing what they do best in times like these. Pony up a couple billion more dollars to either give the tenants or pay off their landlords or pay the landlords directly. Pay off their tenants' back rent. All I know is that, well, we're at the end of today's show. I'll return on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow along with Wendy Wilson. Thanks as always to our producer, Todd. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.